Listening Dog Media.
DJ. Hello, I'm Chris Hawkins, and this is How to DJ.
How to DJ.
The thing about music where it can just give you goosebumps. That's one of my favourite things to play.
So we sent it on the Tuesday and sent it to his record label, Double F Double R, and he played it on the Friday. Then
everything went mad.
I've DJed in great venues all over the world, you know, I mean, the big venues that everyone talks about.
A podcast exploring life stories, techniques, minds and experiences of much-loved DJs, where I ask them to pick five questions from a box of 45. And for this episode, the editor-in-chief of DJ Magazine.
People still do like a physical magazine.
A music journalist.
I needed to work. I did things like go paintballing with Symposium, day trip to Margate with the Aloof.
And a DJ, obviously.
Dance music culture was our lives. It was like a movement. It wasn't just entertainment. It wasn't just a DJ in a bar. It was what we lived for.
Carl Loban, welcome to How to DJ.
Thank you, Chris.
Carl, which came first, DJing or writing?
I'd say writing came first, although I had a go at DJing right around the end of the 80s, early 90s. I was terrible. And then I started writing for Melody Maker. I'd finished college where I went in Leicester, and I was like, what do I do with myself now? I know I like writing and I know I like music, and I'd read The Enemy and Melody Maker, and I thought, I could do that. I could write reviews and stuff. And so I did some sample reviews, sent them in to Melody Maker and Enemy, and Melody Maker said, yeah, right then, you can come work for us if you want. And so I kind of rocked up. I started doing reviews, and then I had this, and that was the start of my music career, I suppose, at the start of the 90s, writing pretty much throughout the whole of the 90s for Melody Maker and then some other mags. And then also I'd start getting sent all this music to review and stuff. You get on mailing lists, and it'd be like Christmas every day. Oh, another couple of bits of vinyl, lovely. And I suppose I thought an extension of my evangelizing about various forms of new music in print would be to actually play these records out in venues as well, like in a club or something. So I still couldn't mix. So playing some of these nice, I don't know, anything from dub to weird electronica to whatever stuff in like the second or third room of little underground parties in Hackney and stuff like that. And that kind of like alternative to the 4/4 main floor became where I liked to play in my early days of DJing.
And was it all electronic music though?
I mean, yeah, I guess so. There might have been, I don't know, something, a sort of a remix of Radiohead or something. But I mean, yeah, I mean, I have done the odd DJ thing where it's been more indie as well, or you know, bands, more band stuff. But I kind of, by the time of the mid 90s, I made my bed in electronic music, really. I kind of got heavily into drum and bass, which, living in Hackney at the time as well, was just all around. And me and our little party crew used to go to all the things. There was this time in the mid 90s where there'd be all these great nights in midweek in London, like there'd be Speed, Movement and PM Scientists all in midweek, and you'd get all the top drum bass people dropping down to play a set, you know, midweek. That'd be a great way of getting a fix of drum and bass. And I started sort of DJing it myself as well. I got the odd warm-up thing at Movement on a bar, remember, on Shaftesbury Avenue, playing drum and bass. And I sort of became one of these annoying kind of like evangelists for a certain new genre, like, oh, you got a drum, almost to the exclusion of everything else. And so my thing would be, oh, to play drum and bass in unusual places. Or so me and my friend Miss Pink would try and get drum and bass sets in squat parties where everyone else was playing acid techno. Or I've infiltrated the ICA, and they'd said, well, we've never had a drum and bass person here before. And I said, oh, let me play drum and bass in your room. Arts Centre place, the ICA on Pall Mall, and similar type things. And I became, I suppose, a fledgling, unknown, not very good still drum and bass DJ, but found out that if I'd play at a house party or something and I'd play my drum and bass, people go, oh, it's too fast, it's too dark, it's too noisy, haven't you got anything good, as people say to DJs sometimes. And I was also getting the house music records and stuff like that. So I started playing more house and then around just after Millennium, I suppose, when Electro Clash came along, I started playing that sort of stuff. And then also breakbeat, which was almost like slowed down drum and bass, like 1/3/5 instead of 1/50/60, whatever. And so I got heavily involved in the breakbeat scene then in the early noughties.
Do you remember your very first time in a club?
My God, I was remembering one of them actually, which was recently just going past the Coco, which used to be called Camden Palace.
Yeah.
And I remember going there as a teenager and thinking that's a bit rubbish actually. I don't really like it. Oh, what do you do? Oh, you have a drink and dance around. but then obviously as I got a bit older and wiser, I got much more into it.
Were you ever into indie bands?
Yeah, I was very much into indie bands in the 80s. Indie was my thing. Echo and the Bunny, you know, a whole range. I suppose my musical journey started, my first independent musical love was Two Tone, the Specials and the Beat and the Selector and all that. And then I got into the New Romantic thing, early 80s, then more the indie alternative goth thing, I suppose, right, moving up the 80s into, well, and then mid 80s had a bit of a looking back, when there was not much going on in contemporary music, looking back at the Jimi Hendrix and the Doors and the Bowie kind of stuff from the 70s and 60s, and then industrial, late 80s, and that kind of went into acid house. And I had my acid house epiphany at Glastonbury in the late 80s, and then I was kind of sold, I was gone, really. I became a bit of a raver, if you like, but I still retained one foot in the indie thing. I'd go and see bands all the time. You know, I still like going to see bands now, even though that's considered a different genre of music. You know, at one point it was very much electronic over here, rock over here, but with Melody Maker as well, there was very much a crossover.
Are you very conscious of not being a music snob, would you say?
Everyone's got an opinion about music, and no, none of those opinions are right objectively. Yeah, we'll as music journalists, people like discovering new acts. I was the first person to write about so and so, whatever, or first person to play la la. There is that element, which is the discovery thing, I suppose. But not to say, I'll take that. They're rubbish. They're just for kids, or whatever. I would say that a bit more when I was younger or something, but now I just think of more commercial pop music or whatever it is as more of an entry point in for kids into music, and then people go on to discover slightly more deeper things.
What got you your job at Melody Maker?
Being on the dole, smoking dope and thinking, what the fuck am I going to do now? Sorry, am I allowed to swear?
You've done it.
Writing sample reviews, going to gigs and blagging me away into gigs and doing a review, sent it in to this guy, well, the Melody Maker and Enemy, and this guy, Jim Arundel, said, yeah, you can start writing reviews for us if you like. And so I'd go to, he'd say, oh, go, and my first gig, my first Melody Maker review was this band called Blind Melon.
Yes, No Rain.
Yeah.
Australian band.
I think Canadian.
Are they?
The singer's dead now.
I knew there was a tragedy involved.
Yeah. They were like a grunge band sort of thing, early 90s, and it was at the Marquee in London, Tottenham Court Road, doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. Did my review, printed in the Melody Maker. Wow, that first time you see your byline in print can be amazing.
Do you remember what you said?
I think I kind of was nice about them, quite liked them. I thought they were all right, and they weren't changing the world or anything. I must have done okay, because then they started sending me to more places.
What was the Melody Maker office like at that time?
Oh, there were so many great writers, great music journalists involved
was
at the
Danny
time.
Was Danny Baker there at the time?
Danny Baker was NME. The funny thing was, NME and Melody Maker, deadly rivals, but they're on one floor apart in this office block, Kingsreach Tower in Waterloo. So there was a bit of rivalry, but also people would go to the same pub downstairs and play five-a-side football together and whatever. But in Melody Maker at the time, there was people like Simon Reynolds, the master, David Stubbs, Simon Price, Neil Kulkarni, God rest his soul, just passed away recently, my friend, which I'm still cut up about, Sharon O'Connell, there's loads of really great music journalists, so passionate and into the whole thing. And this kind of mad ship was officiated over by Alan Jones, a sort of who seemed like an old hippie from the 70s, but he was one of the original rock and roll journos as well. He'd hang out with Lou Reed and with Jagger and Bowie and all this stuff, and it had some tales to tell of his own. So there's like this mad keen, the 90s were just such a blur of, I mean, it wasn't just Blur and Britpop and Oasis and whatnot. There was all this other stuff happening in the dance side. There was drum and bass being invented and coming through, and techno and all these exciting new musics. And us young writers were trying to evangelize about and trying to get a bit of column inches within Melody Maker. So I'd be pleased if I could get a page feature on Ronnie Size or something within all this stuff about Travis and boring indie bands who I considered at the time. Travis, boring, embrace boring, listen to a bit of this. That was kind of my where I was at the time.
Was it carnage in that office?
It wasn't really. You'd think it would be people, you know, doing whatever in there, but they weren't. I mean, at one point it used to be that you could smoke in the office, but then it became that you couldn't. There was a designated smoking room. So the smoking room was where the interesting stuff was kind of talked about, really, which is a bit like smoking areas used to be, where are at clubs or whatever. People have a bit of a gossip in the smoking area. So it wasn't absolute carnage. There'd be music playing and there'd be chit chat and what have you, freelancers dropping in, pluggers coming, PRs coming in, photographers. But I wouldn't say it was carnage. It was just, I mean, somehow a weekly music paper got made amongst all this. People literally would spend whole afternoons in the pub sometimes. But then this, I'm thinking of the staffers here. They'd come back, and I was a freelancer, but they'd come back and still turn out some great copy.
Were you out 7 nights a week?
I wouldn't say 7 nights a week, but I was out a lot, a hell of a lot. People used to joke that I'd go to the opening of an envelope, you know, and do you want to come? Oh, yeah, I'll come. So I did go to lots of things. And in London, in the music scene in the 90s as well, there was always, especially around Christmas time, there was like forever as a company, record company Christmas party. Oh, do you want to go to the Ninja Christmas party, this Christmas party, the XL? And there'd be all these Christmas parties that you just end up in a bit of a whirl, really. But then, and then there's also all these gigs going on all the time, and then clubs at weekends. So I was out a hell of a lot at the time.
Let's stay at the Melody Maker and try and, before finding out why you left, I'd like to know, Who were your DJ heroes? Because by now, by the sound of it, you've started to kind of focus on genres and trying to establish yourself as a writer championing music that you really loved rather than what you were given.
Yeah, who are my DJ heroes? Well, I'd meet and interview some of these DJs, like, for instance, Carl Cox, and they'd be so nice and so such good interviewees as well. Mr. C was another early one, Fatboy Slim, and then a lot of the drum and bass guys as well, your Ronnie Sizes, LTJ Bookham, virtually everyone in drum and bass I interviewed in the 90s at that time.
And these guys were now starting to become, this was the beginning of their journey to superstar DJ status.
Absolutely. So it felt quite good at the time to be documenting this stuff at the time that it was so all fresh and new. And, you know, even though they might be a little bit of a well-known DJ on the circuit, sometimes it was one of the first interviews they'd ever done or whatever. So that was quite nice as well. My interviewing style would sometimes be not too professional, shall we say, but I seem to always get a good interview out of people.
Do you think, you've mentioned, say, Carl Cox and Norman, did you see something in them in the early days, as it was then for them, that you knew they were going to be huge?
Carl Cox was pretty big already by the time I got around to interviewing him in the mid-90s or whatever. He was one of the early, he was there from the start, really. So, I mean, some of these people were already playing to quite big crowds, sort of thing. And then other people would be just a bit newer, like DJ Markey from the drum and bass scene. He was an unknown guy from Brazil who just landed. I just so happened to be at his first ever gig in the UK, where he, with his effervescence and enthusiasm just showed up some of the other more moody DJs, but just by his positivity and joie de vivre, I thought, wow, this guy's fucking great. Let's champion him. And people like him, I must still sort of talk to him to this day. He remembers me as one of the, or the first person to write about him in the UK music press sort of thing. And he went on to have top 20 hits on Top of the Pops with LK and to become an international touring artist. So yeah, sometimes you would meet people at the start of their successful professional careers, if you like, and it's interesting to see how they flourish sometimes from those initial days.
Do you think you help them on their way?
Some of them, for sure. I'd be like, God, I spent all that time transcribing the interview and then making them sound good, even though they talked a load of rubbish. And now look at them. We're earning millions, and there's me, like, not earning millions.
Were you conscious of that, of the wealth that these guys were, the stage that they were getting to?
In the 90s, I definitely wasn't conscious of the money thing. And I don't, the money thing wasn't that great at the time. It was like people were eking a living out of DJing, really, and then it only really started exploding in the late 90s and the sort of advent of the, I suppose, superstar DJ and super club, as they might be called. And then around millennium time, there was that it sort of, that New Year's Eve when promoters were charging ridiculous amounts of money for people to get into clubs, and there was a kind of backlash from that, and it kind of imploded slightly just after millennium around that time. So, but then Even then, I remember hearing a certain DJ was getting 20 grand for their New Year's Eve Millennium gig. And I thought, that is so much money. But now, what compared to what some DJs get, that's chicken feed.
Why did you leave Melody Maker?
I was one of the last to leave, actually. This new editor took over from Alan Jones, who was great. This guy was brought up from NME, from the floor below, and I think it was the publishers. They saw identical front covers from Oasis's Nebworth gig and thought, hang on, we've got these two titles and they're the same, so we've got to make them a bit different. And they brought this guy in from NME, Mark Sutherland, who was, as soon as he came in, loads of people left because he blatantly wasn't cut from the same cloth as most of the existing Maker writers. And he just basically took it down the toilet. It became like, in order to do a feature on a band, you had to do something wacky with them. Like, well, so I needed the work. I did things like go paintballing with Symposium, day trip to Margate with the Aloof, all this kind of stuff, which was fine. It sometimes gave a new twist on things. But then also he'd be like, right, and so I want to put Louise from Eternal, who's now Louise Redknapp, on the cover. And me and Neil Kulkarni and some other people would be going, why? Well, because, you know, we want to appeal to new markets, and doesn't even write her own song. Don't matter, or the kids like. And basically, he took it down the toilet. And I stayed on for quite a while, but I'd also started freelancing for other magazines like Generator, Wax, and DJ Mag. I suppose my saving grace at the time was the four-page orbit section, the dance section in the middle of Melody Maker, where we still could write about whoever we wanted. And the guy who was overseeing that left, and I thought, oh, it's going to pass to me now to do it as the next in line sort of thing. And he just said, oh, I'm just axing that section now. And so I thought, right, fuck it, I'm off then. And I didn't have anywhere to go. But the people at DJ Mag, who are a really nice team, they pretty much said, oh, well, come work with us. And I sort of fell into DJ Mag just for the millennium, and I've pretty much been there ever since.
For any younger listeners, it's really important, I think, to note that these publications, the Melody Maker, NME, DJ Mag, they were absolutely enormous. And Melody Maker and NME, absolute Bibles.
I thought it was criminal what happened to Melody Maker, because it was founded in 1926 as a jazz magazine. You know, it went through all these twists and turns, rock and roll, punk, alternative, goth, la la la. And then this final chapter is just this guy just making it really shit. And, you know, the embarrassing stories slagging off UK Garage because it wasn't a dour indie band, or I don't know, just got the tone all wrong. And he drove it into the ground, unfortunately. So that's tragic what happened. And but at the time in the '90s, those papers, they were devoured by people in the music industry, in the music scene, from bands to, I mean, everyone read them. You know, they had huge circulations of 60,000-80,000 a week or whatever. Yeah, that was just definitely an era. And I suppose it's just in the digital era now, it's just different.
How different is it?
It's different because, well, we've found at DJ Mag that people still do like a physical magazine. But obviously, things have changed. It used to be in DJ Mag, people would write house music record reviews, because the only way to find out about a new tune would be to read a review of it. You couldn't go online and listen to it. You'd maybe read a review of it and then go to the record shop and say, oh, have you got such and such that I read about in DJ Mag? And they'd go, oh, yeah, we have. We just got it in. And that would be one of the chief ways to find out about new music, maybe a bit off the radio as well or whatever. But now there's kind of less need for, should we say, single reviews, because, yeah, someone could wax lyrical about how, you know, Sonic Cathedrals, how this tune took me to the skies or whatever. But the best way is just to press play on it on the internet to be able to hear it. So there's no real so much need for singles reviews anymore. I'd say it's different with albums. People like a critique of an album, a bit of an album review still. Long form features about artists, what motivates artists, themes linking different elements of the scene, both UK wide and worldwide or whatever. That's where you want a long form feature in a magazine. And it seems that people still do want that.
What was your first piece for DJ Mag?
Oh, I remember one of my first pieces for DJ Mag was about an internet radio station that I went down to, and you know, and I was kind of amazed that the DJ would put on a record, and then they'd get comments from Canada, or I'm talking 1997 or something. Oh, there's people listening from Canada, and they're immediately commenting on this forum. And I was, you know, it was quite a revelation. It wasn't like pirate. It was a pirate internet station called Interface, I think. You know, and yeah, I was amazed that it wasn't just people within a 2 or 3 mile radius of a housing estate in Tottenham who could hear it. It was people who, if they were plugged in, could hear it throughout the world. I remember that was one of them. And I also went on the road with Chemistry and Storm, the drum bass duo. I think it was down to Brighton and maybe somewhere else, just driving in their car. Storm was driving, Kemi in the front seat, and I was kind of interviewing them from behind. Tragically, 2 or 3 weeks after this article came out of being on the road with Chemistry and Storm, Kemi was killed in this car accident of them when they were driving to a gig somewhere. And it was just a real tragedy for the whole drum and bass scene. But that actually brought me sort of closer to some of the people in the scene as well, by the fact that I'd got to know them. You know, I went to the funeral and everything. And yeah, that was another of my first pieces for DJ Mag.
Why is DJ Mag important?
Wow. Well, I mean, in the 90s, the dance music culture was our lives. It was like a movement. It wasn't just entertainment. It wasn't just a DJ in a bar. It was what we lived for. It was what we did. We got so into it. To have a magazine or whatever that tried to cover different elements of the scene was great. And I suppose that's why I gravitated towards it in the late 90s, where I started writing stuff for it. And it's just grown DJ Mag exponentially with the international growth of the dance music scene as well. It's truly gone global. You know, your David Guetta's and Tiesto's and Calvin Harris's and all these type of people playing EDM, if you like, have just gone absolutely global. They play or have played everywhere in every country you could think of that has the infrastructure to put on a show by them. And it's been interesting to see it grow like that, grow into such a huge industry as well, globally. And then what happens in the shadow of that as well, in the underground, is really interesting as well. When new people come along, new artists, new genres, new technological developments, try and reflect it all in DJ Mag and feed into the scene and make document culture to an extent.
When did you become the boss?
there was, I suppose, well, when I became editor, 2015, I think it was. So it was a different journey. I did every other job sort of thing, I suppose, you know, from features editor, music editor, web editor, you know, all the different things. And then when this guy Ben Murphy left to go freelance, I was kind of next in line, really, I suppose.
10 years as the editor of DJ Magazine. Does that feel special to you?
It feels like, I mean, if I'd got that job when I was younger, might have gone to my head a bit or something, or I don't know, I might have gone off the rails. It's had its stressful times when we were kind of under resourced, and you know, I'd be working all hours to try and meet the deadline. It now feels like we've got it to a really good place, and the magazine's looking better than ever, stronger than ever, and it's come out of COVID stronger as well. There was a wobbly time during the lockdown when there was obviously no events, and so no shows would be advertising, nothing would be advertising because there was nothing going on, really. And we managed to sort of navigate through those tricky waters and come out the other side. And now it seems to be doing better than ever.
What's a typical day at the office like?
People think, oh, you know, it's going to be, you know, people tossing 12-inch records around or shout. It can be quite sedate, but we like to have music on. It's not a bank to be vibing about a new track by somebody or whatever it is. And we've also got filming video stuff that we do there as well, like with our story of series or whatever. So quite often we're having people dropping by, artists or PRs or whatever. Not quite as buzzy as the Melody Maker one from the 90s, but you'd be surprised to hear, maybe. But I suppose, you know, at the end of the day, it is still a place of work as well. It's not a youth club, and we do need to still get a magazine out every month.
I'm pretty sure that someone listening now would love a job with you. What does it take to write for you?
Sometimes it can be literally what I did. Show us what you can do. Do a sample review, or when people pitch us stuff, like freelancers, they'll be like, "Oh, I've written for such and such and such." So get some work published somewhere, and then save the links or save the cuttings or whatever, and send them to us so we can see what you can do. Because like, just someone coming out of the blue and saying, "Will you commission me to do such and such?" We're like, "Well, how do we know you're going to be any good or whatever?" So you need to have maybe some sort of proof, but it can just be sending us stuff. You know, like I remember like a couple of people who went on to have senior editorial positions. I got them in as an intern initially.
Can you name check them?
Alan McGrath, Ben Murphy.
Amazing.
And then, and also my current deputy editor, Ben Hindle. I was doing this lecturing at Southampton University about music journalism, and they had this one thing there to do the students' magazine in a day. And so there's these students on this music journalism course. There's this kid there, and I said, okay, who's going to have different roles within this magazine then? Like, who's going to be a designer? And he just went, I'll be the editor. He was a first year, and some of the others were second and third years. But he just rocked it. And I said, I should get you starting to write for DJ Mag. And he started to write for DJ Mag, and now he's my deputy editor.
What have been the highlights for you in your time at the magazine?
I've been lucky enough to travel the world.
Yeah.
You know, I've DJed in Brazil and China and all these places, hung out with some amazing people, had some funny, mad times. I couldn't say what the absolute highlights have been. Quite often there's a new thing every month or something that's kind of a bit of a wow moment. But yeah, I suppose some of the big things where you think, God, am I actually going to be able to do this? Like one time in Brazil when I had to stand up in front of 10,000 people or something and give an award to Green Valley, who had just won the top 100 clubs poll, and shitting myself beforehand, but then it being absolutely fine in the end, or DJing to large crowds or that sort of thing.
How big a deal is DJ of the Year for the magazine?
The top 100 DJs poll. We run it every year, and we have done since the 90s. In fact, we just released a 30-year anniversary doc on YouTube, and it's actually chosen by voters. We don't choose it at the magazine. If us editorial staff chose the top 100 DJs, it'd be a quite different list to how it turns out, because a lot of the people on that list are more from the commercial genres, I suppose. But what it does do a lot is shine a light on DJs internationally as well, like some from Egypt or Brazil or wherever it is. The kind of the most popular DJ in that country tends to rise up and get into the top 100 list, because loads of people from Brazil, if it's Brazil, would vote for them. And then suddenly, like this guy Alok, who's now number four, he's in the chart. He is from Brazil, and he actually says in our documentary, you know, if there hadn't been this poll to shine a light on the fact that I was quite popular in my own country, then I wouldn't have started getting these international gigs. And promoters from Asia or whatever use this top 100 list as a bit of a Bible, and they're like, oh, well, we want someone who's high up in the poll. Get me number seven. Number seven's not available. Get me number eight.
So does that mean that you get introduced to new DJs as a result of the poll?
Yeah, absolutely. We have done. And when we got the results list, we're like, God, who's this? Never fucking heard of them. Are they real? And they look into them. And, oh, actually, they got 2 million followers in Indonesia or wherever it is. But yeah, all the time, there's literally scores or perhaps a two or three dozen every year who maybe get into the poll we possibly haven't heard of before. And then we're like, so they must be getting all these votes from Egypt or wherever it is they're from. And then they start touring internationally.
Who's the greatest DJ of all time?
Who's the greatest DJ of all time? I've got my personal favourites. And DJ Marky, who I spoke about earlier, is one of them. Also, French guy, Laurent Garnier, Danny Tenaglia. And I've got to say Coxie as well, Carl Cox, because he just radiates just good vibes always, and is such a nice person. But there's so many that nowadays, there's a whole new raft. They're kind of older DJs who, you know, I've seen numerous times. But there's a whole swathe of younger DJs who I love and who are great as well.
What is the current state, big question, current state of UK club culture, would you say, Carl?
I mean, with COSY Lives, cost of living, having hit, and also COVID, the hospitality sector is slightly struggling and needs support, whether that be governmental support and or people going and supporting more independent venues and new up and coming bands, new up and coming DJs. People do need to realize that you know, the UK is amazing for music. You know, what for a small country to have exported so many great acts globally is amazing. And that petri dish, the nurturing of new talent through comes through new little venues or whatever is really important that happens, and some places are struggling. The energy bills that clubs have to pay, or you know, getting taxed here and there, and VAT, and I mean, the Nighttime Industries Association conference just down the road from here that I've been attending is talking all about the problems of licensees and the issues that are involved there. It's you know, it could be things like the opera get funding, but dance music clubs don't get funding. I think there should be more state support for some of these important small elements of music culture.
Have you got anything left to do that you feel like you still want to achieve as a DJ or as a writer?
I've probably got more books in me. I co-authored a book about drum and bass, Renegade Snares, 2-3 years ago, where during lockdowns when we got most of it done with my pal Ben Murphy. DJing, I still get a buzz out of DJing, and I've started a record label with my pals Irvin Welsh and Steve Mack, and that's been going great actually in the last year and a half. So putting out these new tunes and sometimes playing some of them out on the radio or in clubs or whatever has been a real buzz. And yeah, I'm just gonna carry on doing it because I enjoy it. DJ.
Hi there, I'm Jack Wood, and this is Ticket Stubs. It's the podcast for the gig goer. We celebrate people who cannot resist during a conversation saying, I've actually seen this song live. For people that are down at the front or afraid of being at the front and want to stand at the back, we are bringing the inner fan out of every single guest we have on this podcast. And my goodness, we have got some good guests. Rising star Anthony Smerick, who gave his love of all things Glastonbury and some amazing surprise sets. We've had the Zootons on, who I have to say was absolute lovable carnage, and we really got to hear all the things that have inspired them over their many years of going to gigs and performing at gigs. We've had Tom A. Smith coming on and talking about friendships with unlikely, incredible, huge artists, and Connell Kelly, who has given us a glimpse behind his first ever crush that happened at a gig, and you might recognise the name. All of this and more, basically celebrating everything we love about live music and everything we hate as well. So join me for the brand new podcast, Ticket Stubs, right here.
All right, Carl, it's time for the first of your five picks from 45 questions in this record box at my side here. All the questions are on 45 sleeves. I'll dip into the box. You say when, I'll pull one out.
When?
Your first question from the box, Carl, is what's the craziest time you've had as a DJ or with one?
Oh, Christ. One that immediately springs to mind is when I was DJing with Barry Ashworth, who I believe you've had on this podcast, from the Dub Pistols, and he does the Mucky Weekender Festival now as well, which I highly recommend attending. So me and him were playing in Warsaw, and I think the people were there anyway, gave us loads of substances and it was difficult to carry on DJing, and Barry was just like crashed out in the booth, like on the floor. He was like, oh, I can't do it anymore. I'd sort of carry on. I've had other times when also I've been fed substances, and it becomes a bit tricky to sort of navigate the equipment. the lights start going in funny ways, and I suppose I've had quite a lot of those kind of times with or without substances over the years.
That's part of that. I'm back into the box for question two. Say when.
Stop.
Are DJs better than ever?
Are DJs better than ever? I mean, DJs have more tools at their disposal than ever. You know, obviously it used to just be two record decks and a mixer. Now you can plug anything you want into it, really, and have an extra drum machine or extra this and that. Ableton, you know, all these different ways of DJing doesn't mean that just because there's more bits of equipment that people can be better. I mean, there's when people do remix stuff on the fly, that's pretty impressive. And you know, someone like Richie Horton or whatever, when they do all this high tech technical stuff, James Abelia crops to mind, then it's impressive. But at the end of the day, sometimes if it's just about rocking the party, all this technical wizardry isn't necessarily the number one thing that you want to be focusing on. Perhaps people just want someone to play an old house classic so they can jump around to it, rather than see someone wiki their way through this, you know, this technical maze. But ultimately, are DJs better than ever? There's more opportunities for DJs to be better than ever. So I guess they probably are, actually.
Back into the box. Question three now, Carl.
When?
What do you choose to leave off your bio?
What I choose to leave off my bio is probably some of the more incriminating stuff that I've got up to over the years, with or without other DJs, perhaps, or whatever. I'm only talking about substance abuse, really, substance taking. Yeah, bios tend to be where you make out that you're quite professional and all the rest of it. So anything that maybe detracts from that, I'd probably leave off my bio.
Back into the box, Carl. Your fourth question.
Stop.
Okay, so one sentence. Complete this sentence. I hate DJs when they...
Ooh.
You can have a moment.
Yeah.
Or a couple of run-ups.
I hate DJs when they don't read a room, I think, or have maybe just... They're the warm-up. They're the first DJ on the thing. No one's dancing. There's no one... And they just come in and bang it from the off. They bang it from the off and they don't warm up the room. They just think, I've got my set that I arranged at home in my bedroom. I'm just going to play that, and haven't given any thought to that you might, dancers might want to be eased into it a little bit rather than just bang, bang, bang from the off when that's not really going to work.
Your final question from the box now.
So,
where is the best dance floor in the world?
Wow. Does it still have to exist, or can it be a old dance floor?
An old dance floor's fine.
I used to love Space Ibiza, which is now High Ibiza, which is still a great club. In fact, it got voted number one club in the world in our last Top 100 Clubs poll, as Space did for years when it was Space. I loved it there, but it can be a small dance floor for me. It doesn't have to be this huge arena or anything. In fact, sometimes the smaller the better. A small little 100 or 200 cap venue, you can have an amazing party and time in. But I'm thinking now, things are coming into my head. I'm getting flashes of one in Brazil that was really amazing that I played in at Green Valley, the second stage there, the Underline. I'm thinking of this place in Ecuador, Lost Beach, which I've also had amazing times at. And then UK places, underground Hackney parties that we used to have in the 90s. Yeah, I don't know if I could say one on its own.
Understandably. There were 5 questions from the box, Carl. This podcast is supported by Flare Audio, who are brilliant in-ear specialists. And I'd like you to name a favourite song to listen to alone through earphones. So what is the one track that you think is perfect for solo listening?
Okay, I'm going to say New York and Soul, Black Hole of the Sun, 4Hero Remix.
Yeah, incredible piece of work. Yet never gets old.
Yeah.
Still sounds fresh.
On headphones, I can't remember when I last listened to it on headphones. I bet it still sounds great.
A good 5 minutes as well, I think.
And the rest perhaps, yeah. And it's not a banging whatever. It's just a beautiful piece of music.
Carl, one last question. You have to play the last 3 records on Earth. It's the end of the world, right? What would those 3 records be?
Christ, I don't have... Oh, blimey. One of my earliest dance tunes that I ever got into, Blue Monday by New Order. Then I'll somehow segue into LK by Marky and XRS, a drum and bass Brazilian samba-ish thing.
Superb, that would work well, yeah.
And then I'll finish off Dawn of Summer, I Feel Love, Giorgio Moroder production for 15 minutes. And then as that's fading, what would I do? I don't know, I'd call my loved ones, or hopefully have them nearby, and jump off the cliff.
I think, yeah, with your arms raised to rapturous applause.
Something like that.
Thank you so much, Carl.
Cheers, Chris. Really enjoyed that.
And that was How to DJ.
Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow us wherever you get your podcast from.